Please be seated. Maybe 22 years ago or so, Dan's mom and stepdad took the extended family, including us and our children, to Disney World here in Orlando. It was February, and of course we were coming from Illinois and Indiana and Pennsylvania at that time. We did what a lot of people do when they go to Disney or to other amusement parks. We decided we would all wear the same t-shirt, the same yellow t-shirt, so that if we should become separated or if somebody should wander off, it would be easier for us to identify one another from a distance, and we'd be able to find each other more easily. On top of this, we thought we could buy unique hats that we would wear all the time for the same reason. Makes sense, right? Well, it's a great idea, but when you get to Disney, you find yourselves wandering among several hundred people, and you quickly see that lots of other families and groups had the same idea. Clumps of same-colored t-shirts are everywhere. And because there's only so many bright colors out there, there's a lot of people dressed like your family. But they're not. This idea applies to the hats as well. Lots of hats worn by lots of people, and you find out that they're not quite as unique as you thought they were when you bought them. You ever wonder if the disciples did that? All wear the same color tunic so they could identify each other in the crowds? Or maybe wear a red bandana or something like that? Imagine being a penguin or a sea elephant or a flamingo. I'll give you a second to do that. When you look around you, everybody looks the same. Oh, no! How do you know who belongs to whom? Oddly enough, when babies are born or hatched into populations of parents in many species like that, the specific smell of a mother or father, or the very subtle peculiarities of individual voices, variations in feather and whisker patterns that you and I wouldn't notice at all, these details are so strongly imprinted in the minds of the offspring and those of the offspring in the parents, that even in the middle of huge crowds of seemingly identical animals, if they just keep making noise and looking and sniffing, they find one another. This is amazing to me. It tells me how poorly we are trained to listen and notice things, unless you're Jason Bourne, maybe. Of course, having smell on their side makes a big difference. It wouldn't help me much, but it helps them. When I was a kid, my mother had an amazing ability to whistle loudly enough to be heard for close to a half mile. I don't know how she did it. I don't want to know how she did it. I could be riding my bike with friends or playing almost anywhere in the neighborhood, and if my mother wanted me home or wanted my attention, all she had to do was walk outside the door of our house and whistle. I knew that whistle. I knew it close by, and I knew it far away. It was shrill and irritating. It might be so faint that no one else would hear it, and sometimes I would even hear it inside a friend's house. But I could hear it, and my reflex was to respond. So even in the fray of hundreds of bellowing sea elephants, young and old, a mother can find the pup from which she has been separated. Now, my wife told me not to say this next line. Am I saying my mother was a sea elephant? No, I am not. Let's make that clear. Do you suppose that that's why we turn to God? Is it because God's voice, God's touch, God's person is so strongly imprinted on us as we are created by God in His image that eventually we just find God because we're responding to something deep inside us that says, I know that voice. I have to answer. That would be nice, but I don't think it's true. It certainly seems like not everybody hears that voice, or that same voice doesn't stand out in everybody's spiritual ears. But Jesus said, "My sheep know my voice." Sheep respond to the specific voice of their specific shepherd, and not to the voice of other shepherds. So how do you think Jesus found his own followers in a crowd? Or how did they find him? How do we find him? In today's gospel reading, Jesus retreats to Galilee in reaction to his cousin John the Baptist being arrested. He resituates himself in Capernaum, a bustling Greco-Roman city where no doubt he and his father had gotten a lot of the business that they had as tradesmen. Long before Jesus figured out that he was called to preach or to minister among God's people, or at least long before his time to do so had come, from his new base in Capernaum, Jesus begins to collect disciples. But he doesn't use the method of gathering disciples that was typical of rabbis in his day. In Jesus' time, a Jewish man became a rabbi by spending a good portion of his life learning the tradition. Scripture is a huge part of the tradition. At that time, Jewish boys by age 12 would have memorized Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. This was standard stuff. It was expected. These same boys would be able to tell you where all the stories on characters and incidents can be found in the text, carrying on arguments about their significance. And keep in mind, there was no such thing as chapters and verses in those days. At the age of 12, most of these boys would stop spending time in school and then would begin to follow in their father's footsteps, learning and earning money in a trade of some kind. It was time for them to earn their keep. The sharpest, the smartest boys, however, would be given opportunity, if they could, to remain in school and to memorize the remainder of what we now call the Old Testament. The Psalms, the Prophets, the wisdom literature, of which we have some preserved only in the Apocrypha. That's a lot of material. These remaining boys finished their education by age 15 or 16. And they could think and argue at a different level than those who had finished their education at age 12. But then there was a third level of rabbinic education, the best of the best of these boys who had learned all the scriptures. Just a handful were given opportunity to petition a particular rabbi and apply to be one of his disciples in a more intimate way, learning how and why he argued the way he did. Learning the important points of theology and the finer points of rhetoric that gave one the ability to speak eloquently in public about what seemed to be true and pertinent in the scriptures. These select young men would interview with their potential rabbi mentor, and he would either accept them or reject them as his student. Disciples at this level would follow their rabbi around so closely that they didn't miss a word. And they literally would be covered with the dust that he kicked up as he traveled on the dirt roads of Palestine. Jesus, however, seems to have broken all these rules. He becomes a rabbi, but we're not told how much traditional training he has. He can pass any test, of course. He clearly knows scriptures very well. Even at age 12, he's found conversing and arguing in compelling ways in the temple with the rabbis there. They were amazed at Jesus' level of expertise. Jesus did not just automatically know the scriptures because he was God, though. He was also fully human. He knew the scriptures because he had been taught, trained as any Jewish boy raised in the context of a faithful family and community, even though he was clearly gifted as well. But Jesus certainly breaks the rules when he calls his disciples. He does not seem to care about the disciples' level of education or whether they were even eager to follow him. He just pulls men out of the routine of their daily work and says, "Follow me." These men must have been astounded. No other rabbi would even consider them to be potential followers because they were not qualified. But because Jesus could see deeply into people's hearts. He found his own disciples and he compelled them to follow him. Apparently, these men just dropped what they were doing and followed Jesus. Hard to imagine. Did they have what it takes to be a disciple? Well, according to all the other rabbis and traditions of that era, no, they did not have what it takes. But Jesus was not looking for education in his disciples. He was looking for passion. The kind of passion that might urge a person to consider their career or livelihood or other things they might normally consider to be important as not worth clinging to, so long as they had opportunity to follow this Jesus. That's amazing. Right down to choosing his disciples, Jesus held to the notion that the first should be last, and the last should be first. His ability to choose disciples on this basis gave him a group that would change the world with their experience of being with Jesus, his miracles, his healing touch, his teaching, seeing how he lived and imitating him. Jesus could see through the crowd to find the inner yellow t-shirt, if you will, that these disciples wore. More than anything, they knew that they were not worthy. And more than anything, they were willing to lay down everything. Everything to follow. I know very few people who would qualify to be the disciple of a normal rabbi. I suspect most people who have PhDs in this day and age, where we are so dependent on other tools for learning, would not be able to memorize the entire Old Testament. But I think all of us would qualify to be followers of Jesus if only we would put our lives in perspective and learn how to let go of things. Jesus says to his disciples, follow me. He says this to you and me. Follow me. This does not mean learn all the right information about me. It does not mean know what you believe. It does not mean you don't really feel it unless you react to the gospel in this way or that way, or get whipped up by this kind of music or that kind of music or that kind of preaching, or wear the right Christian t-shirt or read the right version of the Bible. No, follow me simply means follow me. Walk where I walk. Do what I do. Jesus laid his life on the line not only when he hung on the cross, but every day of his life. He laid down what he had a right to be proud of and did not take ownership of the very identity that he had been given. The identity that he could have clung to be powerful or to be saved from attack. Instead of doing that, Jesus emptied himself. We need to follow him. He made himself a slave, and we should follow him in that way. He did not consider equality with God, which in his case was his identity, a thing to be grasped, a thing to be clung to. He just emptied himself so that he could be used in whatever way God wanted to use him. Follow me is what he says. So let's follow him. Are we willing to drop everything that we think is worthwhile? Things that put food on the table, that give us self-esteem and make us think that we are who we are? Are we willing to drop all of that and follow him? When Jesus asks us to follow him, we don't get to say, oh, I'll follow you 2 hours a day, or 2 days a week, or I'll follow you in these parts of my life, but you better leave those other parts over there alone, because they don't need to be changed. No, we don't get to say that, because we don't know what needs to be changed. Everything needs to be changed. Jesus knows you in a crowd. You don't need a yellow t-shirt. He can find you by your smell. So be careful. By the quiver in your voice, when you whimper in the middle of a mosh pit. He knows you by your insides. And that's what he wants to change. When we follow him, everything must be put on the table. Everything about us must be laid on the altar. Especially those things that we think are best about ourselves. Those things that we think don't need to be changed. Because they must be what makes us special, right? We're wrong about that. We don't know what makes us who we are. It's because of those things, especially those things that we love about ourselves. It's because of those things, especially, that he came. If you don't think you need to follow him in some particular way, well, that's the way in which you need to follow him the most. Like the 12, we don't deserve to be Jesus' disciples, but we are the ones that he chooses. And he knows what he's doing. He knows that we need to change, and that changed lives change the world. We don't need degrees to follow him. We just have to lay it all down. The biggest burden that we lay at the foot of the cross is not what we are sorry about. It's not the stuff that we really feel like we've hurt the Lord with. The biggest burden we need to lay at the foot of the cross is what we think we don't need to be sorry about. It's the things that we think make us who we are. Because we're wrong. We're wrong about what makes us who we are. Andrew and Peter dropped their nets. They dropped their lives in their boats and just walked away and followed. We need to drop our lives in our boats as well and follow.